Welcome, Tigers and guests. God, that feels good. That feels really, really good. It's good to see everyone in person. By attending our virtual events and asking questions and staying engaged and making donations and spreading the word about Suncoast Tiger Bay, you've helped to keep this club alive and relevant. The Suncoast Tiger Bay Club serves as a civic commons where thought leaders and citizens of all political stripes come together to discuss the pressing issues of our time. Now, these conversations have always been important, but over the course of the past 16 months, they have become a vital lifeline, keeping us all connected and informed. I urge you to keep the conversation going. Please become a member and attend our thought-provoking programming throughout the year. Before we begin our program, I just want to give you a few important club items. As we have returned to our in-person events, membership renewals do continue. Thank you to those who have completed your annual renewal, and if you haven't, you can do that today. You can see Amy in the back. Today's program will begin with 25 minutes of moderated questions with our panel of experts, followed by 20 minutes of Q&A from you all. Only Tiger Bay members and young Tigers will have the opportunity to ask a question during the Q&A. Our guests will have 1 to 2 minutes to answer each question. Today's Tiger Timer is a board member, Barkley. Sorry, got you off guard. And finally, the return of our prestigious Fang and Claw Award. We have not been able to do those virtually. The rules for the Fang and Claw Award. This is the question session. Actually, the rules are on your table, excuse me. Again, only Tiger Bay members and young Tigers may ask questions. And when you ask your question, you'll have 15 to 20 seconds to frame it. No speeches. Wait for the mic and please state your name clearly before you ask your question. At the end of the question session, we will rank each question and give this prestigious award out to the winner. We do have 3 audience members who will be ranking the questions. If you can raise your hand. Perfect. Okay, thank you. Now, young Tigers. We do have 1 young Tiger in the group. If you can raise your hand. Yes, welcome. Our club is committed to the development of our future leaders. We call them young Tigers. Each luncheon, we welcome local high school and college students into the discussion. Today, we've got Everett Klein. He's a sophomore at Northeast High School. You can help support our Young Tiger program by sponsoring a table or a luncheon altogether. And you can also talk to Amy in the back about that if you'd like to do that in the future. Suncoast Tiger Bay also supports future Tigers with an annual scholarship for graduating Pinellas County High School seniors who have demonstrated community involvement and leadership. The black bowls on your tables will give you an opportunity to help us in this mission. You can make any donation you'd like and put that just in the black bowl and we'll collect it after the luncheon. We'll now welcome all of our elected officials and candidates in the room and ask them to introduce themselves. We'll come around with the microphone if you can just stand.
Hello, I'm Nicole Carr, Pinellas County School Board, District 3.
Hello, Eric Lynn, running for Florida Congressional District 13, being vacated by Charlie Crist.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Daryl Roussan, your state senator, District 19.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Gina Driscoll, St. Petersburg City Council Vice Chair and the council member for District 6.
Good afternoon, Tigers. Ed Montaneri, Chair of City Council, and I represent District 3.
Hey, I am Frank Kraft. I'm running for U.S. House of Representatives, Florida District 13.
Thank you. Thanks also to Radio St. Pete and Joe Bordeaux for live audio broadcasting of today's program. It's actually on 96.7 FM for the first time. Very cool. As well as our media partner, St. Pete Catalyst, for recording today's program and sharing it on our website for those who couldn't be here today. We also have coverage by Manu Zine in here. Now today, we'll be discussing the Red Tide Crisis. As most of us know, Red Tide is a recurring event for the Gulf Coast of Florida. Many of us who grew up here remember those periodic blooms over the years. It's just kind of what we do. This year, with more than 1 million tons of dead aquatic animals cleaned from our waterways and beaches so far, with communities on the Gulf Coast seeing effects on their ecosystem, health, tourism, and economy, the residents of Florida are asking how, why, and what the hell can be done about this. We are honored to welcome our panelists. You all can come up here and take a seat, and Allison, I'm gonna give you the podium when I'm done. We've got J.P. Brooker, Director of Florida Conservation for the Ocean Conservancy. Dr. Kate Hubbard, Director of the Center for Red Tide Research for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And Dr. Tom Frazier, Professor and Dean of the USF College of Marine Science. Our moderator today is Allison Barlow, Executive Director of the St. Pete Innovation District. And Allison, thank you so much for moderating today. I'm gonna hand it over to you.
Thanks. I'm pleased to be here with you today, and I'm very privileged to be with this panel. I'll share real quick a quick vignette. So I'm the Executive Director of the Innovation District, and I have the pleasure of working with these individuals on a day-to-day basis in the Innovation District. And I always share with everyone here in St. Pete something that you may not realize. You may not realize these folks are rock stars nationally. They are well-known in their field, well-esteemed. If you go to any conference in this field, they will be swarmed with people who want to talk to them. And here we have them in our community, and I jokingly say they're probably in front of you in the grocery line, and you have no idea. So first and foremost, I thank our panelists because they are doing the heavy lifting on this topic that is so important, not only to our community, but the lessons that they're discovering, the discoveries and the lessons learned from this experience also translate around the world. So it's really important to have these conversations. I hope today that we'll not only cover sort of the why, the how, the research, but dig a little deeper into maybe some of the conversations you don't always get to hear about this topic. And also I'm fortunate that these folks all know each other well, and they work together all the time. So I've asked them to make it a conversation and to join in with each other. So we hopefully will be able to get you into a deeper level of understanding about what's going on. So first I wanna start with each of them, take a moment if you would, and just introduce yourself and let the group know who you are. JP, please.
Sure. Really glad to be here. Thanks to the club for inviting me. I'm J.P. Brooker. I'm the Director of Florida Conservation for Ocean Conservancy. I'm a sixth-generation Floridian. I was born and raised in Brevard County, Florida, and I've lived in St. Pete for about 15 years. I'm a member of the Florida Bar. I sit on the Executive Council of the Environmental and Land Use Law Section of the Florida Bar, and I was appointed to the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council's Coral Advisory Panel.
Hi, my name is Kate Hubbard. I work at the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Fish and Wildlife Research Institute, leading our harmful algal bloom research and monitoring team. And since 2020, I've directed FWC Center for Red Tide Research. I first worked on red tide as an intern at Moult Marine Lab when I was a college student at New College. And I went away to the West Coast for graduate school and really couldn't wait to get back here to work on our harmful algal bloom issues, and was very fortunate to do that in 2012. And since then, expanded, working on a lot of different issues. Excited to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, so again, my name is Tom Frazier. I'm the Dean of the College of Marine Science here in St. Petersburg at USF. Before coming here, I spent 25 years at the University of Florida and was the director of the School of Natural Resources and Environment. And the last couple of years in Tallahassee, where I was the chief science officer for the state of Florida. And like JP, I've got pretty strong ties to the fishing community and currently serve as chair of the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council. So there's a lot to talk about today. And again, thank you for having me. I look forward to chatting with my friends here.
Wonderful, thank you. I'll start us off with a couple of questions to set the stage. So I grew up here in Florida, and you know, we've seen red tides in the past. Is what makes this one more unique? And also, how do you track to even know the trends? And maybe start with Kate, since you've been doing a lot of the trend analysis.
Sure. So this particular bloom, I think most of you in the area know that we get blooms almost every year in Southwest Florida, and we don't always see those blooms in the greater Tampa Bay area, but looking back over the past decade, we've had blooms occur in at least 6 of those 10 years. Those blooms rarely make it into the bay as far as this year's bloom made it. And we rarely see cell levels of the organism red tide, Carinia brevis, reaching the levels that we saw this year. So we saw levels in Hillsborough Bay and even into Old Tampa Bay, and that's pretty unusual for us to see, again, with that upper extent, and then also with the concentrations. Those occurrences don't happen very often, and the last time that we saw that, those two things go hand in hand was back in 1971. And so, again, we have a long-term history of looking at these types of events, and there are some different things that led up to this event that probably helped condition the bay for the bloom this year. And one of those things was the drought that we all had. So there was not a lot of rainfall that we saw over the winter and the spring. And that's something that can be really important for the salinity in the bay, which was anomalously high this year. So I'll maybe stop there and,
So JP and Tom, anything you'd like to add to sort of the uniqueness of this year?
So yeah, I mean, I think you just have to go out in the water to see the actual impacts from this red tide event. I mean, anyone who's grown up fishing in Florida can see that we're having more frequent, more severe harmful algal blooms, whether they're red tide in Tampa Bay or blue-green algal events in Southwest Florida or even on the East Coast of Florida. We're seeing this unprecedented die-off of manatees where 10% of the manatee population's actually been lost this year alone. So, I mean, I think what we're facing is a water quality crisis in Florida, and this red tide event is really just a proof in the pudding kind of example of that.
Tom?
Yeah, I would agree with both Kate and JP on a couple of points. I mean, on the bigger issue, I do think that we're facing a water quality, a variety of water quality issues throughout the state that continue to lead to harmful algal blooms, whether they're red tide or blue-green algae blooms or there are other types as well. But as Kate pointed out, with regard to what happened in Tampa Bay, there are a lot of factors involved. I mean, there's, you know, everything just seemed to roll together to create a really nice cocktail of conditions that allowed the bloom to actually initiate it and establish itself in the bay. And those had to do with lack of rainfall, salinity patterns, kind of hydrographic patterns, and winds forcing a lot of that accumulation of biomass into the bay. So it certainly wasn't ideal, a little earlier than we might anticipate as well. So, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, let's deep dive a little bit more into the causes. So we know that, as you indicated, there are some sort of naturally occurring causes and then man-made causes. So let's talk a little bit more. You know, we heard in the last bloom a lot about the Sahara Desert, the Sahara dust, that's the word. And also Tiny Point and things like that. So talk a little bit about what you see as that cocktail that occurred.
Yeah, and I'm going to let Kate weigh in here certainly pretty quickly, right, with regard to what factors kind of lead to the initiation of blooms and things of that nature. But getting a little closer to home, right, and what I'd like to say is that, you know, nutrients in our waterways contribute in a really big way to the maintenance of algal blooms. And so there are lots of factors involved. And so prior to coming to the University of South Florida, for example, I spent a lot of time as a chief science officer trying to deal with these issues at the state level. And one of the things that I did was oversee the blue-green algae task force. And that task force really issued a set of recommendations, you know, in 2019, essentially, that and ended up in the legislation in 2020 that focused on what are the sources of nutrients in our waterways, right? And what can we do to reduce their delivery? And so we tackled a lot of different things. And so sources of nutrients deal with everything from failing septic systems in improperly located areas. We all have fertilizer use that can be problematic if you don't adhere to the best practices. We've got agricultural runoff, but we've got other residential contributions as well. We've got a need to improve our wastewater infrastructure. There was, you know, as part of that legislation, there were efforts to improve power sources so we don't have too many sanitary sewer overflows, right? So we had electric power backup systems there. And there was an effort to improve our statewide stormwater rules as well. So there's a lot in play. I think people recognize the magnitude of the problem, and there's certainly an effort to try to make things better. But we still have a long ways to go because, again, there's 1,000 people moving to Florida every day, and that kind of compounds the problem. So we have to continue to be vigilant and pay attention to these types of things as we move forward. So those are the primary sources. You know, I won't shy away from the fact that we had a Piney Point problem. And Piney Point certainly contributed 200 tons of nitrogen into the bay. So that's a significant fraction of the annual amount of nitrogen that is delivered as a consequence of all of the other sources that I talked about before. And because of the residency time of the water, it's on the order of months in the bay. It takes a while for that water to find its way out. So essentially you have a bit of an incubator, and it's, I think most people would feel that any nutrients that are in the bay, whether they're from Piney Point or the other sources, contributed to the ongoing maintenance of that plume. So it's a problem, hopefully, that, you know, we need to be aware of, and we can take action sooner than later to kind of make sure that we don't have any more of those type of environmental catastrophes around the bay. So I'll turn it over to Kate, because I know that she knows a lot more about Saharan dust than I do.
Well, so we do know that these blooms start offshore, and I just maybe want to look around the room. How many of you have seen some sawdust-like accumulations offshore, either when you're flying over the area or when you're out fishing? Anyone? Yeah, so that's actually a different type of algae, and that type of algae is able to use some of the dust, the iron that comes from this dust. It's able to also take up nitrogen from the air, so that's called nitrogen fixation, and it's able to then convert that into other forms that red tide can use. So this algae often occurs offshore. We've seen it throughout this present event. We typically start seeing it in winter and spring months, and we definitely observe it all the time in our monitoring. And it's something where we know that it can play a role in providing this additional source of nutrients to red tide offshore. To what extent, it's hard to tell. This type of algae is difficult to detect via satellite. That's one of the tools that we often use to try to track red tide once we can see that there's a bloom ongoing. So it makes it a little bit trickier, more unwieldy to track the way that we do some of our other types of algae. But we know that it can play a role in these offshore blooms. Also, you know, as Tom alluded to, there's a lot of different sources of nutrients that can play a role once a bloom moves onshore. And even these trichodesmium blooms, that's the type of algae I was just talking about that responds to the dust. This can occur pretty close to shore. And even over the past month, I've seen it within 15 miles of Tampa Bay flying up over the area. So this is something where it sounds a little bit like alien life coming to the area and contributing to red tide, but it really can play a role. And when you start to see that sort of haze in the sunsets, usually around May, June, that can often be an indicator that there is the dust in the air. And sometimes we see more of it going to the eastern part of the Gulf, sometimes more the western part of the Gulf, but it is something that can play a role in these events. The extent to which it can play a role versus some of the nearshore sources is something that, as you can imagine, with a bloom that moves around the way that these blooms do, it can be really hard to track that and to say this percent is from this particular nutrient. And so that's where it can be really tricky to track these nutrients in the system. But we do know that from lab and field studies, Karenia is adept at taking up a lot of different types of nutrients. And so that's unfortunately a problem for us and something that we have to continue to work on.
Kate, do you think we'll ever get to the point where we can start to narrow down, like in the case of Piney Point, so many people want to say, what was the contribution, how much did it contribute? Will we ever get to that understanding?
I think that what we learn from events like that is how to get more proactive in our sampling, what types of sampling we need to build in so that we're not just doing reactive sampling. And some of the different tracers, like isotopic testing, isotopic sampling, that's something that we're trying to build into our offshore work more routinely. It's something that we're interested in trying to build into some of our nearshore work as well, so that we have a better handle on what those sort of baseline conditions are, so that when there's an event like that, we can also have a better sense of how much that event may be contributing. And I say that still with the acknowledgement that we know that once those nutrients were put into Tampa Bay, they moved around quite a bit. USF had a great tracer model where we could see how those concentrations were moving around the bay. We know that they stayed in the general area for a little while, but then within a few weeks, they were all over the bay at much reduced concentrations. And so it's definitely a complicated issue. And we also know that these nutrients are able to cycle through other types of algae. So there's a lot of different partners involved in trying to work on this issue from a lot of different angles. And that's where some of the modeling efforts really come into play, where trying to work on enhancing our physical models, but including nutrients, biogeochemistry, biology in those models so that we have a more holistic, comprehensive view of what's going on, and we can look both backwards and predict forwards. I think that's a goal that we all share.
And I think that pivots us to a next question, which starts to get into the impacts. So JP, when you start thinking about the impact to marine life, we've seen so much that dead fish, mammals, things like that. And then you start to look forward and you say, okay, what are the implications for turtles, for glia grouper? What kinds of thoughts do you have about what we're seeing now and what will be the future impact?
Yeah, well, essentially, reopening glia grouper to recreational fishing, and that's something that hasn't been done for decades. And because we brought glia grouper to the brink, we fish so many large animals out of the ecosystem, that the stock became inherently unstable. And we're at a point now where the stock has started to come back and where we are seeing more glia grouper in the water. And in places like the Indian River Lagoon, you're seeing a really healthy rebounding stock. But then all it takes is one event like a red tide event or other ecosystem factors to come into play to decimate that stock. And all of a sudden you're pushing yourself back to break again. And so I'm really hopeful that this red tide event, where we've seen so many large glia killed as a result of red tide, I'm hoping that's the nail in the coffin for the FWC's plan to potentially consider reopening the stock. Now, that doesn't say that the FWC was guaranteed that a reopening stock, they're considering their options, but I would say that this should be something that closes the door for glia fishing. As far as other impacts to stocks, offshore fish, gag grouper, red grouper, these stocks are going to be impacted. I think the scientists are going to decide by how much. But these are factors that red tide events are ecosystem factors that are taken into account as fisheries managers make their decisions. They have good mechanisms in place to make those kinds of assessments. But I would agree with some of the case that it's important to be more proactive as opposed to reactive. That's true with fisheries management as well. You can forecast that as water temperatures continue to rise, as nutrient inputs into the ecosystem become more frequent, we're going to have more events like this, and we should be planning for those events in our fisheries management regime, as well as just in our general vegetables for asking. But I pass on particular problems that like to teach our fisheries management.
Yeah, thanks JP. Really good comments. I'll just kind of contribute, I think, to the two examples you provided. I think the glia grouper story is an interesting one, and clearly one that's been on the minds of a lot of people. The FWC is charged. They had a commission meeting this past week, in fact, and I think the intent is for the FWC to come back to that commission in October with a proposed rule as it relates to recreational harvest of glia grouper, and things that they need to consider in a rule like that have to do, the when's, where's, and how's, right? And, when would the season be open? What are the regulations surrounding the harvest? What are the season limits, the bag limits, the size limits, and things of that nature? But I think as part of those discussions, they recognize fairly clearly that environmental events such as red tides can have a tremendous effect or impact on the stock status, and so it will certainly play a role in their deliberations moving forward. So, but again, at present there's no recreational harvest for Goliath grouper. It's something under consideration, and I think conversations like this help to kind of move that conversation along so they're more comprehensive in nature. Go ahead, Jake.
I would just add that, in my opinion, the glia grouper is worth more to the state alive than dead. And I think whether the black tide is a result of a red tide event or as a result of fishing, I think that we can get more from that alive from an economic standpoint by keeping it alive. And that's my opinion. I think not everyone can share, especially, recreational fishermen who want to build parks and trophy. And that's fine. And we should take all users into account. But I think with the stock is over here, it's the one thing we should do everything we can to perpetuate its existence for the long run.
And I guess just to that point too, right? And as you pointed out with Kate, I made the comment that we need to be learning and incorporating some of these other factors, right, into our planning. And so we know the red tide, for example, can have a tremendous impact on our fishery stocks, and we saw that certainly in several years in the past with regard to red grouper. So moving forward, when we're thinking about our projections and what those stocks might look like and how they're influenced by an event like this, we do incorporate that into the planning process so we can make sure that we're not overfishing the stock or leading to an overfished status, so that in fact that we can enjoy that resource for generations to come.
So I'm going to ask one more question before we open it up to the floor. As an innovation district person, I need to ask you about innovation. You know, Kate mentioned at the beginning, we've been looking at these red tides and particularly studying them over the last several decades. What are the innovations that are being worked, whether they're working or not ready for prime time? You know, Tom, you mentioned in the policy realm, looking at agricultural practices, looking at fertilizer bans. And then I know in the practical dealing with red tide, there's been practices with clay distribution into the water. Talk a little bit about what you see as coming, what you have interest in, what you think isn't
going to
work. Tom, you
want to
start?
Well, I was going to let Kate start because she's intimately involved with the Red Tide Task Force or the HAB Task Force, but I'll follow up on that, I think.
I was just going to go back to that question and maybe take it in a slightly different place first, which is to say that we really need to understand when and where these blooms are starting, and that involves a lot of long-term monitoring and advances in our monitoring, how we're looking at the initiation, how we understand the drivers of what's making a bloom as bad as it might be. Because if we are going to employ any of these sort of technologies for trying to treat a bloom, we want to try to do that in the minimal way possible. We don't want to necessarily do that once we have a bloom that's extending across multiple counties and has been occurring for multiple months. And so it's something where that research goes hand in hand, where as we try to think about what types of innovative technologies could be employed, we also have to keep looking to see when and where and how can we improve our ability to detect red tide before it turns into the major types of blooms, the severe events that we see on shore. So I think those two things go hand in hand. In terms of whether anything's ready for the mainstream, there's still a lot of research going on to look at these different tools and techniques. And one of the things that has recently happened just in this past week, Moat has opened up a new facility. It's a mesocosm facility, so it allows a lot of these different approaches to be tested before they go out into the field. And this allows both short-term and long-term studies so that they can look and see what the impacts might be, not just on the red tide itself, but on other organisms, on the environment. And so that's something that's really critical. And again, goes back to the question of when and how and where could these techniques potentially be applied. I think there's also, there's some methods like clay, but there's other approaches too, like some of the other types of things that naturally kill red tide. I often get asked that question, and we know that there are organisms like clams, oysters that feed on red tide. There are other things in the marine environment, other types of aquatic life, plants that will compete with those same nutrients. And so as we think about some of the practices that Tom mentioned in terms of trying to put into effect some of the nutrient practices, those sorts of things, we need those in place in order to think about also how to restore some of our systems so that they can help do a better job in terms of buffering us from these future impacts.
Tom or JP?
Well, I would just add, I think we should be exploring these innovative techniques for dealing with red tide, but we need to fix the underlying problems as well. And maybe that really should be a core focus of ours, and we shouldn't be dealing with some of these things that are going to exacerbate red tides or other harmful outcomes. Again, I mean, it's a mantra that we should all repeat in future and warming waters. Those things are really going to contribute a lot to red tide events and to blue-green algal events and other water quality woes of Florida. So, you know, you're not going to go, if your car's broken, you're going to fix the broken car. You're not going to add a turbocharger to it. I think that we need to fix those underlying things before, not necessarily before, but we need to be focused on fixing these underlying problems. And innovation can supplement that. It's not going to be a silver bullet.
Tom?
Yeah, so you guys are really lucky to have Kate and JP here. They're really good. But just to kind of circle back on something that Kate said, you know, one of the things that you really want to do is be able to have the technologies in place that allow you to be able to better predict or forecast where a harmful algal bloom might develop. So you're in a position to deploy a mitigation technology that would be helpful right before you have a widespread event that covers thousands of square, kilometers or something on the coast. So I think there's a lot of innovation, Allison, that can take place in that space with regard to sensor development and ocean observing systems. And we continue to make advances in that on that front every day. And, you know, it's not just, technology with regard to sensors and computer models and things like that, too. I think Kate made a good point about there's technologies about how we can improve and restore degraded habitats in a much more thoughtful way. And we can introduce, for example, other types of organisms, clams and oysters, but they have to be done in a thoughtful manner, right? Because there's a reason that many of them aren't here today, and it's because we haven't dealt with the underlying problem, and that gets to JP's point, that we continue to have to push our foot on the accelerator and make sure that we address the problems that have been plaguing the bay and other parts of our coastal waters for a very, very long time.
Excellent. So I'm going to open the floor for questions. I'm going to hand off my mic to Amy.
So impact on human health, specifically for the workers who are, doing the cleanup, city and county workers who are exposed in a pretty powerful way to these toxins. Thanks.
So the health impacts associated with breathing in the aerosolized form of the toxins can vary. It varies widely across people. It can also vary depending on your exposure, whether that's repeated exposure or whether that's just a short-term exposure. For some people, those symptoms can go away almost immediately. For some people, there can be longer-term impacts. And to be perfectly honest, we're still trying to understand what those impacts really look like. And there are new research efforts to try to examine that in a more comprehensive way. We know that there are, for example, there's quite a bit of variability in terms of the amount of antibodies that different people seem to produce in response to these toxins, but why that is, whether that relates back to their exposure history, there's still a lot of open-ended questions. I will say that there is the Roskamp Institute in Sarasota has been looking at human health impacts. They have had a few new research projects, and I heard that they were gonna be trying to recruit some new members to a human health study specifically related to respiratory impacts in this greater area. And so that's something that I would keep an eye out for. But it's something where, again, it does vary widely from person to person and depending on that exposure history. In terms of the long-term severe impacts, we don't really have a good sense of what those might be. And so it's still very much, I would say, an active area of research.
Yeah. And Tom, do you want to add anything? Because I know your team is looking at a lot of correlations between human health and ocean health.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important area to start looking at. I mean, we have started, but to continue to look at, and I want to kind of think about the context of innovation, right? And I talked a little bit before about innovations that could take place with regard to ocean observing systems and forecasting and modeling and kind of in-water sampling, but the same would be true for what's going on in the air, right? So as Kate pointed out, these toxins that are produced by the algae are often aerosolized, and that's where they become a problem for humans and wildlife. And so I think there's an opportunity to create kind of a sampling and a monitoring network on land, right, that will allow us to predict where these aerosolized toxins might end up, and so we can protect people that might be exposed in the future. So from an innovation perspective, I think that's where we might go, certainly in the future.
Excellent. Next question.
Jeff Gillespie. My question to you is, what is the role of government at municipal, county, regional, and state level in this state responding to the problem of the red tide, and what are they doing and failing to do which would mitigate the problem?
Well, there is a role at every level of government. I think at the municipal level, there's an opportunity for local governments to lean in and enhance things like fertilizer ordinances. Miami-Dade County recently extended their fertilizer ordinance to run longer throughout the year, and that's to accommodate warming water temperatures, which could influence, alongside the fertilizer, the growth of harmful algal blooms. So the theory being, if you take a wider swath of the year to ban fertilizers, you might get fewer blooms. At the state level, we have seen some forward action on clean water regulation and legislation. Senate Bill 712 was passed the session before last. It's called the Clean Waterways Act, and there are a number of really good provisions in there that will work towards creating regulations for agriculture and regulations for other sources of nutrients. But that's really the first bite of the apple at the state level. And I think that there's an opportunity for us, especially in this upcoming legislative session, to really enhance that existing legislation. At the federal level, there have been considerable efforts to deal with harmful algal blooms, none of which have come across the finish line entirely yet, but there is a strong desire to legislate our way out of that the harmful algal bloom situation. I think, though, what we really need is a combination of legislation and enforcement. We've got laws that are already on the books that need to be enforced, that need to bring polluters in line, that need to bring people to account for the damage that's being done to the environment. The state of Florida just yesterday came out with a lawsuit in the 12th District against the owners of Piney Point, and I think that's a very positive step in the right direction. It's one that we needed, and holding those polluters to account, I think, sends a signal that we're taking water quality very seriously in the state. So it's a combination of enforcement and legislation at all levels of government. It's really an all-hands-on-deck approach that's needed to deal with the litany of water quality problems we're facing.
Bill Johnson, what's the problem, or what is the impact of leaking septic tanks in this area as a contributor to this problem?
Florida has about 12% of the septic tanks in the entire nation, right? And that's a big number. And, part of the reason that we have that many number or that many septic tanks in the state is we don't have enough wastewater facilities, right, to adequately treat or accommodate all the people that are in the state. And with 1,000 more people, as I said, moving here every day, there's a real tendency to continue to permit those waste reduction systems in order to accommodate that growth. What happened, and JP talked about Senate Bill 712 or the Clean Waterways Act, but one of the provisions in that bill was to transfer oversight of the septic system permitting process to the Department of Environmental Protection rather than the Department of Health. And the reason that happened is because historically septic systems have been permitted and regulated on a human health basis, right? But there's clearly a recognition that failing septic systems in particular can contribute to nutrient problems in our environment. And so it essentially recognized septic systems as an environmental problem. And so I do think that's a step in the right direction. They can be a problem. I think we need to get a better handle on where those failing systems are or where those systems exist that were improperly permitted so we can get them on centralized systems and continue to deal or address the issues that they pose otherwise.
So we've talked a lot about getting us to today. What, if you look forward for the next 6 months, what do you see happening?
Well, the good news is that the bloom conditions in Tampa Bay have largely improved, and so that gives us a sense that things can change quickly. The bad news, I will say, is that we are entering a time frame where we typically see new blooms start to pop up from offshore. And so that's something where, as we move into these next few months, we'll be keeping a close watch on that. We've had discussions even today about trying to do some monitoring with some of the gliders that USF can put offshore. These are sensors that can move up and down in the water column. They give us a sense of chlorophyll offshore, which is a proxy for algal biomass. That helps us feed into our forecasting models, give us a better sense of when and where and how those algae might be coming onshore. So we'll be trying to do that moving forward to see if there will be additional, unfortunately, additional impacts. And so that's something where it's hard to say what's going to happen in the next 6 months. I always like to be optimistic and say that conditions will improve, and at some point they will, but unfortunately we don't know how quickly that's going to happen.
Well, I would just add, and this is something you told me, Kate, in a meeting we had a couple of weeks back, and maybe you can just elaborate on this actually. How far along are we in the 2021 event compared to the 2018 event? My understanding is that, you know, comparatively speaking, we're only about halfway along if we're looking at the 2018 event as a model.
Yeah, so the 2018 event lasted for 16 months and impacted 22 coastal counties. And right now we just started the ninth month of this current event. And so it's something where, again, we'll have to kind of wait and see. That prior event did get an earlier start. So this event didn't start until December of 2020. So it's, again, I wish I had a magic ball where I could say, oh, it's going to start and end this time, and I don't. But we are entering our ninth month, which is unfortunate. The good news is that it has moved around, and so it's been a fairly dynamic event. We are also in the beginning of the more active part of our storm season, and so that can do any number of different things. Good news, it could help an event dissipate, it could help transport it to other areas, as we saw in 2018, and so those are some of the things that we'll be keeping an eye on. That prior event did peter out in December, January, and so just to kind of give a sense, typically these blooms do start late summer and fall, and then they wrap up in the winter and spring. And so again, looking forward, hopefully we'll see more of a typical bloom event moving forward, and we'll see an end to this.
Joanna Cheshire, you all are obviously giants in your field, and we're very lucky to have you here. As a citizen, as a resident, I just kind of feel a little helpless. What can we do individually, like when we advocate, what are some steps we can take to help this issue?
Well, one thing that is really helpful in terms of just continuing to monitor the ongoing event, continuing to report observations that you see, fish kills, that's something that we're, Pinellas County in particular, has taken a really innovative approach to trying to remove dead fish before they make it onto shore if possible. I think probably a lot of you are aware that when the bloom was in Tampa Bay, there were crews working all over to try to get those fish out of the system, to remove nutrients, to try to prevent further issues from those dead fish. That's something that continuing to report those to the county, to FWC, that's something that is really helpful. It may seem like a small thing, but it helps us do our job a little bit better. And then there's also other steps, and maybe I'll hand it off to, I know, JP.
Well, I mean, I put on my policy advocacy hat, and I tell you all to reach out to your elected officials and get them as engaged as possible on these issues. We need a lot of outreach and education on these issues. So many people live on the bay, but they don't know how the bay actually works or how the Gulf works, and they don't really fully comprehend these threats. And the more we can educate folks, including our elected officials, the more I'm hopeful that we can have a chance of getting some relief from what seems to be, you know, a perpetual water quality nightmare here in West Central Florida and frankly statewide. So I would encourage you to lean in on your elected officials at the city level, at the county level, at the state level, and at the federal level. We need all hands on deck, like I said before, to really get engaged and solve this problem.
Yeah, and I'll just go back to the previous question and before I get to this one, and you know, what can we do in the next 6 months or what I see? And I think this event actually brought a hyper awareness of the issues. And so I wouldn't lose the momentum in exactly what JP said. You have strong voices and I wouldn't be afraid to use them, you know, and advocate for policies that are going to be protective of our environment and ultimately our economy.
So I'll ask you all to give us your final thoughts, and I'll encourage you in your final thoughts. Is there something nobody asked you about that, you know, you do these panels, you do these discussions, there's something about this issue that you want to bring up that maybe we don't know?
Well, I think just kind of building on some of the discussion, it really does take a community effort. And so we, you know, there's been questions about how do different parts of government work on this? How do they address this issue? How do people get involved? And I think that building that stronger sense of community, getting engaged in different ways, caring about your environment, that's something that being so surrounded by water, it's something that we all really do care about. It's something that we share. And so it is a chance to come together as a community and to work together to try to come up with really innovative approaches, to try to look forward and say, what can we do to make this a better place to live? And I think it is a really great chance to, again, try to get involved in different ways. And so.
Yeah, and I would like to underscore that it's an apolitical issue, this water quality situation that we're facing in Florida. If you're a Floridian, you should care about Florida's water. Florida's water and environment drives our economy. It's also Florida's rife with iconic ecosystems like the Everglades or the Gulf of Mexico or the South Atlantic. These are ecosystems that we want to protect, not just for the posterity of our children and their children to enjoy, but also you know, from an economic perspective. Fishing alone sustains hundreds of thousands of jobs in Florida. Billions of dollars in the Floridian GDP is attributable to clean and healthy beaches. And so if you're a Floridian, you should care about the Floridian environment and you should care about these red issues. And if you're a politician, you should be leaning in on these water quality issues. You know, water quality in Florida should be like corn in Iowa. It should be an absolute no-brainer that you have to care about if you want to have a chance of getting elected. So I'd encourage you to reflect those thoughts when you speak to your elected officials.
So many good comments, man. You know, I think I'm going to take an opportunity to be an advocate for science, right? A lot of focus today has been on an event. And, you know, it'll ultimately go away, but we'll be faced with others. And what was clear today, hopefully that you understand that we have a lot to learn, right? And there's a lot of investments that we need to make so that we can be better prepared to respond to future environmental events such as red tide or whatever it might be. So, again, lots of times when the problem goes away, we don't think that investment is necessary. But it will pay dividends. So I would encourage you to be strong supporters of science and as it informs policy.
Thank you very much to our panel. Please join me in thanking our panel.